let's start off with a little bit of a straw poll. Could you put your hand up if sometime over Christmas in your households you will be having a Christmas edition of the Radio Times or other things magazine? Put your hand up if you actually have a Christmas edition. Okay, excellent, fine. Put your hands down, that's great. Because in many ways, magazines, although they've had a long and productive history and are a huge employer of journalists, and have been since, as Jason Whittaker was saying, the early days of The Spectator and so on, they're shifting and changing, and there's been a marked change in terms of how they've adjusted, certainly over the last two decades. The key things I'm going to be addressing today very much tie in with question four: what strategies were employed by magazine publishers to increase readership in the early 20th century? And as far as the early 20th century is concerned, we're pretty much looking at the first 50 years or thereabouts. But I wanted to just allude to a kind of contemporary aspect, because clearly the way in which we consume magazines, the way in which magazines have online presences and so on, is changing and adjusting, and clearly having an impact in terms of the whole field of journalism studies and so on. But let's turn back the clock a little bit to actually move to the title of this particular session, which, as noted there, is very much listed as Hearth and Home, the Rise of the Magazine Market. And in any instance, we've got a situation whereby magazines will be targeting certain groups in society, certain age ranges in society, certain genders. In other words, all magazines have had a target audience pretty much since when they first started and worked through that. However, magazine journalism in itself, arguably, is still a very much neglected area of study. It's still an area that is ripe for changing a whole variety of key things within this. Some of the key press historians, such as Curran and Seaton and their book Power Without Responsibility, they actually have very little to say about magazine journalism. They focus on newspapers, they focus on the Times, the Telegraph, the Red Tops, the tabloids, and so on. But if you just look at an average list of online media job adverts, magazines are still major employers of journalists. Actually, the magazine market was probably one of the most significant employer of journalists throughout the 20th century. So what I'm going to be talking about today is very much how that magazine market was created and how it tied in with one of the technological developments of the time, and how, again, it really fulfilled a need in the same way as, arguably, social media fulfills a need today. We'll talk about children's magazines. We'll talk about how comic books and issues related to that became very much a part of culture, both for boys and girls, and also how maybe some kind of ideologies were being purveyed through those particular comic book magazines, which some people might have said reinforced the idea of class, reinforced the idea of the kind of British establishment, and so on and so forth. We'll talk in particular about one publishing company which is still in existence today, DC Thompson, who produced everything from The People's Friends to The Beano and The Dandy, and again had a very specific philosophy in terms of how to work, how to actually work within that whole process, and so on. And then we'll talk about the women's magazine market. The fact that, again, huge issues were brought to bear for a changing workforce, a workforce which was developing, and the change of women's roles in society as well. So those are the key areas which, over the next 40 or so minutes, we'll be pretty much focusing on and developing as well, together with maybe some conclusions in terms of what we're going to be doing and what magazines will be doing in future. So, back at the start of this century, FHM magazine, hugely popular. It was selling on average, in February 2000, a little over 700,000 copies on a monthly basis. It's a lifestyle magazine, really the first in the vanguard of what became known as the lads mag format, and it very much was targeting the whole notion of young, relatively affluent, C1, B1, mid-range, and possibly upper young men who wanted to find out how to basically live the best, coolest life, how to effectively wear the right fashions, how to chat up the right women, partners, all of these kind of things were there. Actually, nothing that really wasn't being covered in different forms back in the 18th century with magazines like The Spectator and so on. And you can look at the headlines and things with respect to that as well. But again, although you might think, whoa, figures of over 700,000 a month, very impressive. But if we actually look at the similar data for women's magazines, such as Women's Own, Women's Weekly, and of course IPC's Woman magazine itself, they actually would by themselves sell weekly in excess of 500,000 copies. So clearly there was no doubt about the fact that in Britain at least, it was the women's magazine market which was certainly the key and largest one, if you wanted numbers. So let's begin then by examining what helped bring about this whole notion, this development of the magazine market in Britain during the late 19th and early 20th century, and kind of brought us on board to a whole range of other elements, etc., together with the kind of aspects which you might say, well, this is just a printed version of clickbait, perhaps, or various other areas that connect within place as well. Well, three things that need to be borne in mind. Many critics have actually argued that it was the extension of literacy through the Literacy Education Acts of 1870, 1880 and 1891 that actually prompted the development of a market for light reading. Reading which was entertaining. Reading where you basically didn't have to think too hard. The adventures, the stories were very straightforward. Things were, you know, basically there for you to be entertained. Indeed, contemporary critics at the time often blamed Forster's Education Act of 1870, which technically brought elementary education into the reach of every child. So again, you're teaching people how to read, with of course the proviso that they then need to have something to read to actually fulfil that desire and so on. Many folk actually argued that this was precisely why bad, quote-unquote, reading tastes were developed, and this sense of a high culture and a low culture. It's perfectly okay to read the classics, the notions of Canterbury Tales by Chaucer, the writings of Shakespeare and so on, the Bible, obviously, and to listen to classical pieces and so on. But to read the equivalent of trash literature, it's not really so good. It provides a whole range of other things within that whole field. And Joseph Ackland, who actually wrote a book entitled Elementary Education and the Decay of Literature in 1894, as you can see there, actually noted that the intellectual faculties of the bulk of the nation were too long in bondage. The truth, or education, through the medium of reading would be setting you free. It's difficult, perhaps, for us to appreciate just what it's like to be in a society where you can't read or write. Maybe a similar sort of thing would be if you kind of juxtaposed your experience if you were switched over to a different culture, for instance, China or Asia or other sort of aspects where you'd have to literally learn from scratch. Because the skill sets that we all actually have in terms of, as many of you are doing now, noting things down, even though you could technically say, it's all going to be recorded, it's on a podcast, I'm looking at the slides, they're already published, I don't have to do any writing at all, I can just listen. But we're still kind of getting that reinforcement of key areas that come through. Ackland went on to say, it shall not cause any wonder that when the shackles of ignorance were struck off, there was a rush to the fields of fancy and pleasure. It should not be any wonder that when the shackles of ignorance were struck off, there was a rush to the fields of fancy and pleasure. We don't necessarily want to read worthy pieces of literature. We want to be entertained. You know, that's what human beings want. They want the kind of lowest common denominator. It's how the tabloids function. We work on that key premise. And George Gissing followed this up with a novel called New Grub Street. This is at the time where Fleet Street is just beginning to be developed and so on. And what Gissing actually wrote about in this particular text, you can see it there, a novel, again, part of the whole world of this new, exciting, very lucrative area of novels, this one published in 1891. He suggested that actually the publishing industry as a whole was primarily concerned with producing titles which would cater for a vast readership, which Gissing would describe as one quarter educated. By one quarter educated, he basically means Well, you can learn. You know how to read. Maybe you know how to write as well. But you're not interested in actually really finding out. You know, knowledge in depth. We talk now in the 21st century about deep learning, really going into a topic, finding out a whole range of sort of factors, and surface learning, knowing a lot about a little. Gissing actually talks about a fictional magazine in his novel New Grub Street called Chit Chat. And Chit Chat, he explains, is aimed at the young men and women who can just read, but frankly are incapable of sustained attention. Look, squirrel, puppy dog, squirrel. You've kind of got that very short level of attention, the need of actually sticking in and actually listening to something or actually reading something intently. Gissing would actually say that was being lost. Chit Chat itself sounds like a thinly disguised version of a very popular magazine of the time, which was called Titbits. Now, Titbits was first published in 1881. And that, as you can read there, was a statement taking from the first official editorial of Titbits. It's a snippet paper. It's a paper that collects a whole range of different stories, different elements within that. What we see if you actually read through that particular quote is that Titbits is in the business of producing an easy-to-hand guide to basically combating boredom. So that you've got a whole range of little pithy comments that you can make about a whole range of things, not necessarily without understanding any of it. It's like the equivalent of saying, yes, we can all talk about backstop, we can talk about soft exit, we can talk about hard Brexit, we can talk about all sorts of things. Do we understand them? No. But again, you're looking at that. However, the essence would actually be that you would be not socially excluded. You know, you would be somebody who effectively would be society agreeable. You'd be able to engage in chat and banter, and you would, in contemporary parlance, be relatively cool. You would actually know pretty much what was currently in vogue, in fashion, and so on. Now, on the one hand, Titbits was actually praised because it actually was a way of edifying the masses and actually producing things that you could read easily. And where was this actually being distributed? Well, the first news agents, W.H. Smiths and so on, were established, not surprisingly, at railway stations, at areas basically where people are likely to be engaged in terms of transport and sitting on a train and wanting something to do, and why not purchase a magazine which they can either take home or junk at the end of their journey, but it's a way of actually consuming details and data from that point of view. So you go to your newsagents, you buy your copy, and you go on from that point of view onwards. Great, it's fine, it's a great strategy. You're targeting commuters. You're targeting the growing number of people who, with the advent of the rail industry, are beginning to move to their place of work and wanting something to read to entertain them or keep them occupied whilst travelling through that. And Titbits proved to be so phenomenally popular that lots of other magazines developed as well. These are two of the other similar examples. The Strand, probably best known for serialising Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. Lots of authors, including Dickens before Conan Doyle, etc., E.W. Hornung, would actually submit their stories to magazines and they would be serialised. Why? Strategy number one. Have a cliffhanger ending. You want to know how the story finishes. So if you're actually doing a whole series of journalism things from this point of view, leave it to the extent that you have to buy the next issue, and the next issue, and so on and so forth. Titbits by 1888 was selling an average of 350,000 copies a week. So again, pretty significant in terms of numbers. And rival publishers, clearly noting the success of the title and bearing in mind that flattery is the, or success or imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, replicated various other formats as well. The publishing house Pearson and Harmsworth, which later became Northcliffe, produced Pearson's Weekly, launched in 1890. They also produced Answers to Correspondence. And there was a lot of competition between these papers, because you don't want to buy all of them. You can't afford to buy all of them. You've got to select maybe one, maybe two, maximum, etc. So which ones do you actually buy? And there's a lot of ingenious techniques that are actually used at this time to actually get the punter to actually part with their cash to purchase the particular product. One of the most ingenious, possibly, was launched by Answers to Correspondence. And this was the line that people were given. If any of their readers were injured in a railway accident whilst carrying a copy of the magazine Answers to Correspondence, then the victim would be paid £1,000. Wow. Fantastic. Just make sure if you're injured in a railway sort of scenario, you know, you got your magazine to hand, because obviously that gives you £1,000. It's the equivalent of basically saying if you are carrying, or if you're accessing YouTube at present and you get knocked down through actually being too obsessed with the kitten playing piano, you know, you could claim £500,000. Wow. Stick with it, maybe, or not, as the case may be. During a flu epidemic in the late 19th century, Pearson's Weekly actually sprayed its pages with eucalyptus oil, or claimed that actually their pages were being sprayed with eucalyptus oil, purely and simply to act as a preventative. If you want to be free from cold, buy a copy of this magazine. And as you read the actual copy on the papers and the pages, etc., then clearly you will be inoculated against the flu and so on. Now, they're all gimmicks. But it's inevitable. Harmsworth's achievements in magazine journalism were spectacular. They had great successes, both in terms of the magazines and in terms of the actual newspapers as well. But we're talking primarily here about magazines. And by 1909, 110 years ago thereabouts, Harmsworth was actually publishing nearly 50 titles, which were selling 8.5 million copies on a weekly basis under the brand of Amalgamated Press. So we're talking significant numbers here, sort of numbers that FHM would have killed for in many ways. Amalgamated Press went on to actually develop a whole range of boys' newspapers, newspapers that actually went on to incorporate a whole range of other factors as well. And this huge growth between the start of the 20th century and the First World War, the Great War, those are the kind of areas that we're dealing with. This is a huge industry. This is something which is just really phenomenal, whatever your kind of views about that. 50,000 different periodicals. That's a lot of shelf space and a lot of areas battling for covers and so on. We'll come back to this later. Chums. It's the first classic case of a whole range of stories that connects, targeted specifically at the younger reader. The reader who's aged pretty much between 8 and 14 or 15 is usually male. So we're talking about boys, we're talking about children readership and so on from that point of view. And the whole notion of Amalgamated Press, which also would introduce magazines and comics like Wonder, Marvel and so on, The Wizard being another case in point, this is another stage to all this, as a notion of, well, you know, clearly if you're a commuter, you're going to go for the more serious magazines. But if you're a child at prep school or a boarding school or a child in school, in any case, you might be looking for the more action, the more dynamic sort of aspects, things that will kind of replicate things that, again, are seen as in fashion or appropriate and so on. You may even go for the boys' own magazine, fairly explicit in terms of who it's targeted at and so on and so forth. So what we're seeing here is a targeting of magazines to specific areas of society. And changing occupational trends as well open up to promote the whole notion of developing titles that featured characters that would appeal also to women. Women who might be working in factories. And you see a lot of stories which feature in their lead roles mill workers, shop assistants, domestic servants and so on, all of which are accompanied in the magazines by advertising. Two things going very much hand in hand, advertising and promotional materials and so on. And those advertising boards are situated strategically on boards at railway stations and elsewhere in town centres and so on. As I said, publicity gimmicks, very common. And the use of cereals, cereals, S-E-R-I-A-L-S, as opposed to the cereal that we eat, by the way, just in case people are confused about the system from that. But cereals very much tie in to getting people to buy more than one copy of a magazine. We can tell this by the number of newsagents who effectively were annoyed by the number of customers they had to deal with, for people saying, we have to buy more than one copy to actually go through this, etc., etc. So clearly, there is a need in the early years of the 20th century for literature. Might be trash literature, might be seen as literature of a lower level, but it's still inevitably sort of very popular in terms of the line that we're coming through. And this literate readership, this growth of the market, etc., opens up a whole range of other elements within that. According to the historian Roberts, in his account of growing up in Victorian Salford, the magazine's vast increases in circulation didn't come through their literary content. This was not a case of great writing, although admittedly we might look back now and say, that's a real classic. The Gentleman Thief Raffles, written by E.W. Hornung. Fantastic. It opens up a whole range of sort of things, etc. But actually, in a lot of cases, people would buy magazines not only because of the major gimmicks that I've alluded to, but also things which we maybe recognise today. Introduction of spectacular competitions, which actually offer the readers the chance to win dazzling cash prizes or pensions for life. Now, inevitably, this growth of the magazine market also has a lot to do with marketing and advertising. A line that I used when we were talking about mass media. The role of commercial media is to deliver audiences to advertisers. Kind of constant line, I actually said. And to a large extent, in this particular era, long before cinema, long before radio, long before television and so on, you're looking at similar kind of techniques that are working through that. As Ross McNoble actually notes and writes, British wages did permit more or less anything that made up working class pastimes. So we're also seeing the development in this period of organised sports. Mass sport, the football and rugby leagues, other sort of areas. Popular betting is becoming very much in vogue. And there's also a modest domesticity, finding out how to actually cope with your particular domestic circumstances and so on. If the servants of your household are actually leaving to get better jobs, how do you actually cope within that? With family sizes declining as well, there was more disposable income which you could spend on younger family members. And that also opens up this whole notion of children's magazines and areas related to that. Now, prior to the First World War, the majority of children's magazines were targeted at boys. There were titles such as the one you see up there, The Boy's Own Magazine, Young England, Chums, and The Captain. Now, all those titles were very much middle class in orientation. They were aimed primarily at boys between 10 and 15 years of age. And they celebrated the public school. They celebrated the whole essence of amateur sport. This was a recurring feature. You'd also have, in terms of Chums, lots of detailed information about sporting techniques, especially regarding cricket, especially regarding athletics. As MacDonald says there, you're looking at something which is very much focusing on what it is to be British, what it is to be born. And remember, this is a time when Britain effectively rules, administrates over a third of the globe. This is at the height of British Empire. It's the Edwardian period in England. In Britain, it's just past the Victorian era. It is this whole notion of, as MacDonald says there, that combination of idealism and innocence and so on. And it's one of the reasons, it's often argued, that when you look at the huge challenges that were faced in the First World War, because you're almost, brainwashing is a loaded term, but because you're almost beginning to get people to think about this, that's why you obey orders unquestioningly. You simply will jump into all of it because it's the right thing to do, old chap. Worthwhile noting in terms of where things are going in. Glory, honour and sacrifice, the supreme values of an ancient race. There we are. Look, £4,000 in one prize. And you've got Sexton Bralake's Christmas Truce, or special Christmas numbers from that point of view. So again, targeting a whole range of sort of aspects and lines within that. Now, just as we can turn around and say, oh, all these role-playing games and multi-things, they don't have any impact at all in terms of people's lifestyles and so on and so forth. And just because you actually happen to have lots of ammunition and are addicted to computer games doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a massacre on your hands. Maybe not. But there are kind of connections that maybe we can actually draw between some of the aspects within that. So if, basically, you were looking at how to develop your interest in sports and you're a keen angler, for instance, or a cricketer or an athletics person, etc., you want to find out more about that sport. You want to find out more about things that are available. And if you are a keen, enthusiastic in your teenage years, etc., you'll buy magazines that connect you with that. Again, the major components of the pre-war boys' magazines, as we mentioned, were tales of daring do. They were perfected by writers such as G.A. Henty. Chums, as we mentioned, set its stories very much on the frontiers of the empire and took a very pro-British Empire stance. It would expand upon the virtues of British pluck and the enthusiasm and the drive of that. And middle-class manliness was actually defined very much on the pages of these magazines in terms of three key characteristics: tenacity, daring, and moral decisiveness. Now, again, you might think, well, that's nothing. You know, these are just basically standard guidelines which are developing good character traits. But the language of good behaviour was often borrowed from the sports field, and the whole notion of playing the game, being on good form, usefulness to society, loyalty, were all connected to be very much at the forefront, even though there was very much a class divide between the middle classes, the upper classes, and, of course, the lower classes, who might probably read even more trashy-based literature. They might even actually want to have comic magazines as they emerged in the 1920s. Now, there's a whole story we could actually tell in terms of the growth of the American comic book magazine market, which was very much established primarily by European emigrants into America, or first-generation emigrants, which the likes of course, Stanley Lieber, better known to us all as Stan Lee, was one example. But we don't have time to actually go into that, and I'm happy to talk about it if you wish at some other future date. But in terms of Britain, there was this whole notion of how things were being grown, how they were developing, and so on and so forth. What you're also seeing in a lot of the kind of magazines that are particularly of this period is a regretful nature, sort of a notion that professionalism was wrong, that the amateur was right, the tall, clean-limbed, athletic amateur would always be celebrated above the bullet-head, bull-necked professional. So clearly, if you are actually writing on magazines, you feel a certain responsibility. Even as a journalist, if you're writing fictional stories, you're putting stories together to actually get people to write more magazines and so on. And clearly, there is this sense of being entrusted with a responsible task. You were training the future generation of citizens, you were addressing some of the central issues of the day, and you're including aspects which would reflect on things like the nature of morality, the possibility of decadence, and the duty of patriotism. Now, following the First World War, known at the time as the Great War, of course, the children's magazine market expanded and started including more and more girls in that particular aspect. And we see a whole range of titles beginning to appear for the female market, again, the 10 to 15 age range in particular. Comic magazine titles like School Friend, School Girls Own, School Girls Weekly, and Crystal, as well as obviously these editions of Beano and Dandy in the 1930s. DC Thompson not only went on to produce this, but they also produced a number of adventure-based magazines, things like Adventure, The Rover, The Wizard, The Skipper, and The Hotspur. And again, all kind of opening up different sort of notions of daring do, adventures, and so on. And Tough of the Track, who we see there, the sort of the bubbles coming through, I've run them all, etc. It's great. All this kind of action and adventure stuff. So you're really sort of capturing that whole notion of an enthusiasm, a drive, and so on and so forth. Again, according to Ross McKibben, a majority of boys of all ages and in all kinds of schools would read comics in the 1920s and 30s. Wizard was actually read by half of all grammar school boys and two-thirds of senior schoolboys across the country. A quarter of that time, girls spent reading magazines. Also, as well as their own magazines, they'd read boys' comics, despite the fact that, again, if you look at them, they make no concession whatsoever for any female readers that they might have actually had. Many children would read more than one magazine or comic. In a 1930s London survey, over 50% of children would read three or more comics a week, and of that number, 30% would read six or more. So again, big industry, big business in terms of how many comic magazines you actually take. Quick straw poll, put your hands up if you've actually read any comic book magazines in your lifetime. All right, wow, that's unexpected. Okay, right, hands down. Put your hand up if you were persuaded to get, or you used pester power to persuade your parents or whoever bought the magazine to purchase a magazine on the basis of it had a free gift and a shiny tie or something on the front. Yeah. Okay. So it's still connected to other services. We like shiny things. Okay. So multiple arrangements, multiple readers. Each particular comic magazine is being read by lots of different people. And you've also got a situation whereby people, children will swap their magazines. Again, you look at a whole range of things which embeds the whole culture of comic magazines still further into the playground. It becomes very much a kind of standard state-of-the-art thing. And even during the actual 1940 World War II period, when there was a restriction on paper, comics were still very much in vogue. And of course, there was no restriction on paper that was being imported from the United States, which is why a lot of the pulp magazines, Superman, Batman, and so on, would again begin to emerge in terms of the British market as well at that stage. So in the 1950s, which is kind of like the furthest we sort of pretty much touch upon from this, we then see the first of the beginnings of traditional comic books beginning to suffer. Because by this stage, mass media has begun to impact. Cinema is very much there. Television is opening up. Obviously, cinema is in colour. You've got sort of a whole range of other elements within that. And really is an attempt to address both that popularity and kind of return back to the notions of comic books as being good, healthy versions. The Eagle was actually launched in the 1950s, very much to borrow from the American model of superheroes or heroes who are basically the very much traditional heroic lines. It was a pictorial comic. Again, you can see the cover there with Dander, Pilot of the Future, and his faithful servant Digby from that point of view. And its sales were in excess of 1 million per week from its original founding in 1950 until basically pretty much throughout the 50s and early 60s and so on. And although the children's magazine market in general suffered from television, comics also would go on to do what other magazines would do, which would be to appropriate television. They would run comic book strips of television series, television characters, etc. Some magazines such as Magnet, which brought Billy Bunter to the world, magazines such as Wizard, etc., also had 6 or 7 different kinds of story, which varied from being a school story, a joke page, a competition with prizes, a war story, and so on. And all of them would try to obtain their readers by featuring a regular character, whether it was Dander, whether it was the detective adventure, Adventures of Dixon Hawk in Adventure, or the Wolf of Kabul in The Wizard. Interestingly enough, if we actually look at the editorial lines that the editors take with respect to magazines, they often tend to adopt a fairly surprising, well, some might say intimacy with respect to the whole thing. The opening pages of The Wizard actually has the editor saying, step right up and have a chat with your editor. My dear chum, see the heading? That's the spirit. No hanky-panky. Get right down to bedrock and have a chat. You and I like two pals. Boys' magazines in themselves became the subject of a celebrated attack by the writer George Orwell in 1940. And Orwell actually wrote that their political assumptions of the comics are two. Nothing ever changes and foreigners are fun. Their mental world, according to Orwell, was stuck at 1914. There was no slump, there was no unemployment, there were no trade unions, there were no strikes, there was certainly no fascism. And the working class were absent except as comic figures or villains. The magazines are also full of racial stereotypes. Most whites were good, except, of course, the Germans. Blacks and Chinese were the subject of intense ridicule. And the evil Chaz Feng was fond of saying the white race will learn one day the power of the yellow peril. Interestingly, one character, Jew, the black giant of Nigeria, once rather inexplicably went berserk and terrorised both Bedford and Leighton Buzzard. Now, it's difficult to agree if you actually look at some of the archive editions of these magazines with Orwell's attack on such magazines, but it's also arguably difficult to start measuring the impact of this reading material on impressionable minds. A large number of those who voted for the first time in 1945, for instance, and were brought up on the traditional reading matter, actually voted Labour. So that, you know, again, might have been an interesting line where technically you would have said, well, surely if they really believed everything in the comic book magazines, they would have voted a, you know, good, solid Republican Tory and so on. But again, it's interesting in terms of how comic magazines also showed a diversification within the children's magazine market. There were also lots of specialist magazines targeted at boys which related to particular sports and hobbies. including actually a magazine that was originally entitled, or at least geared up for young pigeon fanciers, and it was called The Boy Fancier. I don't think you get away with that target today somehow, but still. So let's talk a bit about DC Thompson and that whole notion of the Beano and Dandy before we move on to women's cycling magazines and so on. Who oversaw the writing process at DC Thompson? Well, they specifically, in Dundee, had a clear, unambiguous line that they wanted to approach with their readers. They wanted to have the right sort of person working for them, whether they were going to be writing on the People's Friend, the Wizard, the Hotspur, the Beano, the Dandy, and so on. Editing staff would effectively be looking to manage the whole business of journalism. The company at Thompson was non-unionised. Morale was generally high, and the paternalistic nature of the firm guaranteed good wages and job security. If a title failed for whatever reason, the editorial team would be transferred onto other duties. And some of the Thompson staff would actually sort of be producing a whole range of activity which might have actually gone on for 50 years or four, so working for the same company. But the company's employees were carefully screened, primarily by what we'd refer to now as psychometrics. So before they actually were taken on by the company, they had to sit a test paper. And as one of its editors noted, the aim of that test paper was to try and find out which way your imagination or your brain or your thoughts actually tended. What was your general knowledge about the world around you? And on that, you either got the job or you didn't. The relationship between the writer and the editor at DC Thompson was also fairly close. That was primarily to ensure that the stories were written to the firm's exact specifications. All of the writers were freelance, as I said, no, it's a non-unionised firm. None were actually kept on the staff. And writers were visited by senior editors who'd provide them with a roster of story ideas for 6 months of work. And the journalist's output pretty much was substantial. If you think a 2,000-word essay is somewhat a lot to actually ask, one freelance writer claims to have actually written 8 million words of fiction during his 8 years of working for the firm. So that's a million words per year. Total fiction having to be made up and written. So an awful lot of working needs to be done from that. And many of the writers of DC Thompson would switch from writing for the children's magazines, the Dandy, the Beano and so on, to producing copy for women's magazine titles produced by Thompson, including The People's Friend. Which brings us neatly round to women's magazines. And why has he got this image of Bearings on sale here? Well, as I mentioned, magazines for women specifically tended to emerge after World War I. However, between 1890 and throughout the early 1900s, there were a range of specialist women's magazines which started to appear, which would cater for the sporting interests of ladies of leisure. So clearly we're talking about upper middle class folk here, the sort of folk who kind of have the time to begin to think that maybe emancipation is a good thing, that maybe an equality and a franchise should be taken on board, because you're not actually having to slave away to raise up people, and you're in basically that whole line of being the upper middle class, etc. So we have titles such as The Lady Cyclist, also Bearings. Cycling for women was very much an emancipatory sport. It was emancipatory activity because you could actually get on your bike and pedal off to all sorts of exciting places and adventures. The Wheel Woman of 1897, the Hockey Field of 1910, Ladies Golf of 1912, and the Golfing Gentlewoman of 1914. Pretty much echoing the kind of interests that if you were a young lady of breeding and style and wanting to very much be up at the upper edges of society, those are the kind of things that you'd be looking for. They were primarily intended to instruct the women of England and Britain in the art and pastime of that particular event, in this case cycling. They were also designed to be, and this is quite an important point, a medium of intercommunication between women who cycle. So again, cycling is seen as, again, a way of actually socially connecting and building up links and various other things, and maybe talking about ways in which society can change as well from that point of view. As I mentioned, women's magazines continued to expand in the interwar period between 1918 and 1938, with some 60 new titles being launched between 1920 and the start of the Second World War. Many of those titles had a domestic bias. There were titles such as My Little Home. There were titles such as Mother, Woman and Home, Good Housekeeping. The slide there of the lady is one of the magazines which is still actually in operation today, very much aimed at the upper echelons of society to actually deal with people who are connected with palaces of Westminster and so on and so forth, royal families and such like. Now, at the top end of that particular area, magazines such as The Lady and also The Queen would cater for the aristocracy. They would cater for the landed gentry, people who effectively you would now regard as the establishment. But a new range of magazines was also being aimed at the affluent middle classes, even though it's fair to say that the circulation of The Lady in particular would also be read by the socially ambitious. So if you actually wanted to say, well, I might be middle class now, but what would happen if actually I could become the Edwardian version of Meghan Markle, if we actually had that sort of time machine? How do I actually sort of learn what the right thing is to do, what the appropriate deportment is, etc.? Well, you read the stuff, you find out from there, it kind of soaks in. That way you won't have any embarrassing concerns when you're actually asked to a dinner table. Do I start off with the cutlery at the start? Do I start outside? And so on and so forth. That new range of magazines, though, which was aimed at the affluent middle class, very much included the whole notion of expensive monthlies and this particular title, which is very much at the heart of so much of the what would now be regarded as the middle class scene, and also importing from America the notion of good housekeeping, especially with really impressive strategy here to actually develop ways of buying this magazine, the good housekeeping seal of approval. Now, these magazines were slightly different from the weekly publications that we've talked about. These were magazines which, in the main, were monthly. So they basically, you know, obviously, published about 12 or 13 times per year or thereabouts. And they included Good Housekeeping, Women and Home in 1926, My Home and Modern Home in 1928. We might see from their titles who they're being targeted at. Are they being targeted at people who are commuting to work? Maybe, if ever. Most cases, people obviously have ownership, home ownership, and so on. And the emphasis of many of those new titles was very much on informing middle-class women how to run a home. Because that's what we need to do for a middle-class woman. We need to know how to run a home, particularly when society is changing. You can't get the servants. Problem. Or the servants are becoming more scarce. Domestic technology is becoming much more important. Whereas previously you might have actually just asked the maid to clean up after you, now you might have to use new technology, not a broom, but possibly a Hoover to actually work through that. In her work, Catherine Hallwood, the writer, actually took a good close look at Good Housekeeping magazine. Now this, as I mentioned, was an American magazine, which launched its own British version in March 1922. Women's magazines have often been seen as playing a crucial role in the advancement of the cult of domesticity. The cult of domesticity. And many women's magazines, if you look at adverts at the time, and you look at the branding that comes through, and the stories as well, tries to elevate the image of women as not sort of being stuck at home, but being genuine homemakers. They were attempting to dignify what elsewhere could be seen as drudgery. You know, there are lots of images of how when the lady of the house gets her brand new vacuum cleaner, suddenly it's like everything is easy, everything sparkles and so on. And from the 1920s onwards, as the standards of many middle-class families continue to rise, with, again, servants becoming much more difficult to hire because they're going off to where better money and better jobs is, more attractive employment opportunities and so on, so you're getting a much bigger growth of the market for these magazines. Now, on the one hand, many women readers were absolutely thirsty for information about domestic technology advances. They were keen to find out how you might have a sewing machine that could kind of impact in terms of your needlework and various other areas. But on the other hand, bear in mind that the manufacturers of sewing machines, washing machines, Hoovers, they've got to have people to sell to. Remember that line of delivering audiences to advertisers? So it's a wonderful opportunity to ensure that you can actually advertise in publications that are being read by the people you're trying to sell product to in the first place. Almost a virtuous circle. And Good Housekeeping capitalised on this because they introduced the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval. This effectively meant that any particular piece of technology or device that was featured and reviewed in Good Housekeeping magazine would basically offer a full refund which obviously means that you're likely, if it proved to be unsuccessful, if people didn't actually rate it, well, there was a problem. And it's that good housekeeping guaranteed seal of approval. So it's a wonderful way of conflating the growth of consumerism, technology, buying the stuff, etc. And then if you're not happy with it, it doesn't matter. You could always ask for your money back because of the good housekeeping seal of approval, etc. Now, again, in the early 1920s, the assumption of advertisers in good housekeeping was still that they were aiming at women who primarily were enjoying domestic help in the home. Labour-saving devices such as the vacuum cleaner were being sold as an aid to the domestic servant rather than to the lady of the house themselves. 1923 advert stated that the Hoover is no longer a luxury, it was a necessity. It frees you and your servants forever from the tyranny of the broom. The tyranny of the broom. And as the 1920s progressed, there was also a gradual shift in terms of how things were being portrayed within this. The housewife was then being portrayed, and again, if you look at advertising, lots of these things are online, you can see the way she's using the vacuum cleaner through polishing furniture ads, always looking as though she's thoroughly enjoying the experience, and it's the thing that we all do. Now, I'm kind of ending with this little slide from Cosmo and Glam, etc., because I'd like you to compare this with the one we started off with from FHM in terms of the way sort of target things are being used and other elements within that. One thing we haven't actually mentioned as yet, of course, was the growth of, in Britain, Woman's Own, which launched in 1932, and Woman in 1937. Now, those magazines weren't filled with adverts for domestic technology, but their stated aim was very much to enhance the domestic capabilities of their readership. And Woman's Own actually launched itself in 1932 with this in its editorial. How do you do? We introduce ourselves and our new weekly for the modern young wife who loves her home. Woman's Own will be a paper with a purpose, a paper thoroughly alive to the altered conditions of the present day. The home paper that makes any girl worth her salt wants to be the best housewife ever, and then some. We know kind of the ideology that's coming across from that point of view. And of course, the first edition of Woman actually came with a free gift, and the free gift was a ball of wool. Genius. And that again set the pattern for subsequent issues. It also contained the first episode of a romantic serial. Features would include the right sort of frocks, the way in which people relate to getting the right man, and a whole range of other things. In other words, still echoing the kind of lines that we see here with respect to Happy Ever After and so on and so forth. So, that's taken us through over 100 years, actually, of the 20th century in terms of magazines from its original inception through comic books right the way through to contemporary stuff, taking us all the way back to, as we said, FHM, its demise and various other factors. Didn't even mention Zoo or Nuts or any of the other sort of lads mags that were actually there. Where do we go to in the future? Is it all online? Do people still like the tangible magazine-based structure? That's open for discussion. Not in seminars, because you're still doing presentations in the next 2 weeks. So congratulations to those of you who have done the presentations so far. I think everybody's passed so far, so that's great. Look forward to, obviously, the next round next week. Make sure you sign the register. Thank you.